I found a story this week about a woman named Randy who's from Louisville, Kentucky, who moved to New York City to try and make it big as an actor. And while she was on the streets of New York, guess what happened to her? What? Someone just say she died? That did not happen. We'll have to talk to you later. No. But no, it's similar though. It was her death was threatened. So a mugger walked up to her, said, "Give me all of your money. You wouldn't be the first person I've killed." And what do you think she did? She give him all his money, you think? Or have you ever, when you're really, really stressed out, you just start talking and you won't stop? That's what happened to her, apparently. So apparently, she got really, really stressed and just started talking. And she, you know, she wrote the story down later. And according to her, this is what she said to this mugger after he said, "I'm going to kill you if you don't give me money." She wrote, "I don't have it as bad as you do, sir, but I'm sleeping on my floor right now, and all I ever eat are ramen noodles. Not that that makes me lose weight or anything. You know, people from Kentucky call and they say, 'Oh, wow, you live in New York City,' but I don't have the heart to tell them I'm just a cliche, the kid who moves up here to change the world with her theater. I'm not going to change the world. My theater stinks, really. I miss my mom, I miss porch swings, and I miss sweet tea. So would you please not kill me so I can just go back home where I belong?" And you know what the mugger did? What do you think? He gave her a hug and let her go. According to the story, at least, if it's true, that's what happens. That's what happens. Sometimes you feel kind of broken and you feel stressed out, and what you really want is somebody to hug you and just let you go home, right? Just someone to say, "Go to somewhere you're accepted. It's stressful. You're accepted somewhere else. Go there." Sometimes that is handy and helpful. Last week, Ryan started this sermon series off, and Ryan is downstairs right now, I think, so I can make fun of him a little bit behind his back, but he knows. He said he didn't have an easy passage, and I'm just like, I gave you the easiest passage in the series, buddy. But he started off this series with the easy passage about finding Christ in the Old Testament, because it's a Christmas series, one of the times where Christ is kind of foreshadowed or typified or alluded to of what will come in the New Testament. And it makes sense that that will work, right? Because if God is the same God of the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, then God's Son, who is also God himself, is going to show up in the Old Testament, right? If he's the same God, then he is, so he'll appear in the Old Testament. And last week we heard the story about Moses lifting up a symbol of suffering and pain and evil, and Jesus himself said in the New Testament that just as Moses lifted up that symbol, so he too must be lifted up. And we see our suffering and pain and even our evil put on Christ's shoulders as he was lifted up, and if we look on him, then we are healed. This week we're in the same series looking for when you can kind of get reminded of Jesus when you read the Old Testament. And we're going to do so by talking about a biblical character with whom my older son shares a name. Who knows what my son's name is? Anybody? Not everybody's going to know it. Eli, but it's not really Eli. That's not his full name. Eli's like not a good role model. What do you think is?
Elijah.
Elijah's his name. Although he thinks his full name is Eli Big Boy Daniel Block. Sometimes I can get him to say Elijah Big Boy Daniel Block, but Elijah. Eli's not a good guy in the Bible, but Elijah's actually a really cool guy in the Bible. What does the name Elijah mean? Anybody know? Elijah means Yah, so the Elijah, the Yah, Eli-Yah, Yah, which is short for Yahweh. Yahweh is my God. That's what Elijah means. And so it's a pretty cool name. And speaking of that name, though, it has that abbreviated form of Yahweh in there. Speaking of God's divine name, I'm going to do sort of a disclaimer real quick. I respect God's name, but I'm going to use it a few times during the sermon because, I mean, I think it's useful in the context that we're in. The sermon material today is going to cover a time period where there were people who believed in lots of different gods. There's actually going to be a battle between gods. And if you just refer to all of them as God or Lord, it's not as good. So I'm going to use God's personal name, even though the translators did not use that. You don't actually see God's personal name, Yahweh, or another way of saying it through one tradition is Jehovah, you might have heard. Just the J becomes a Y. So that's how it works there. Yahweh or Jehovah, you don't hear that often. You don't see it in many Bible translations because they're trying to take the route of don't use God's name in vain. And if you just never use it, you won't use it in vain, right? Sort of. That's the theory there. But the biblical text, actually in the original Hebrew, has God's name there. Problem is, I may not be saying it right because we don't know how to say it because over 1,000 years passed with no one ever using God's name because they wanted to respect it so highly. And so we don't know what the vowels are of the word. We just have the consonants because they didn't want to even write down the whole name. And so I'm going to use what is most likely, we think, nowadays, probably, and I'll use it a few times. I'm hopefully still respecting it, not using it in vain. That's my goal. But I will use it because in the context it works. Now, in the Bible text, you'll see L-O-R-D, Lord, in all capital letters. That's when the translators chose not to use the Hebrew of God's name and instead just write the word Lord, following that practice of, I don't want to use God's name in vain. And so, when you see Lord in all capital letters, what you're actually seeing is God's name, they just didn't want to write it down in a non-respectful way. So they went, like, way overboard, which is an ancient practice of doing that, but it's what it is. And so when we see that, I will often today probably say Yahweh because it helps the context of this battle between God's work better, I think. I hope. So there's the disclaimer. But my son's name has it in there. It's my God is Yahweh. And Elijah, the biblical character, had to live up to that several times. He actually, because on several occasions, he had to be the prophet who says, no, your God is not God. Baal is not God. Asherah is not God. Yahweh is God. And here is why. And he lived up to that a lot and had to be that man for that role. So much so that some people don't even think that's his real name. They think it's just the title that he ended up with later on in life. And that's what got recorded. But I don't know. I like the name. And so we'll see it. Because he had to live up to this name often because even though he lived in Israel, which is where the people of God live, right? Israelites were not always good at following God, were they? I mean, neither are we. So you can't make fun of them too bad. But the Israelites were not very good at following God, especially when they had a bad king who kind of did bad things. And there's this king during Elijah's day and age named Ahab. Have you heard of Ahab before? Have you heard of Jezebel before? More people have heard about Jezebel. Jezebel is Ahab's wife. So it gives you some of the character of Ahab because he went out and married her and brought her to Israel. And so here's the introduction for Ahab in 1 Kings chapter 16. We'll be in chapter 18 today if you want to turn there, 1 Kings 18. But 1 Kings 16 is where Ahab is introduced, and it's bad enough I was just going to read it. Here it says, Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of Yahweh more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria, and Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. That's a great introduction, right? It literally says he's the worst. Like, that's what it says about Ahab, is he's the worst guy yet. Maybe not the worst ever, but at that point in Israel's history, he was the worst king. He was the worst one to come around. And you might have heard me say Baal. It's Baal is how some people say it. I grew up hearing Baal. Baal is what I learned later, so I'm going to go back and forth to the same name for a bad god that's not a real god. Ahab brought Jezebel to Israel. He was the worst one ever. He ruled for 22 years, but he was just not a good guy. Did terrible things. He built a temple in the name of Baal and a temple in the name of Asherah and put those within the borders of Israel. So just not good things, right? And so he does all this, and right after Ahab's introduction, though, another character who's kind of the opposite, the antithesis of him, is introduced, and this guy is Elijah. Elijah shows up on the scene, and the very first thing you see out of Elijah's mouth is basically says, Ahab, you're the worst. To prove so, God's going to cause a drought, there's going to be famine in the land, there'll be no rain until I say so. And that's what Elijah says to Ahab. And if you're a powerful king and somebody walks up to you and says, you're terrible, God's going to punish you, are you happy with that guy? Usually, I mean, hopefully your heart is broken like King David. When David messed up, a prophet came to him and said, you're terrible, and he went, I was terrible. And so that's why David was a little bit different. But Ahab instead tries to kill Elijah, so Elijah lives in the desert for a while. He goes off in the wilderness. During that time, though, in the time between where we just read and where I'm going to start reading, Jezebel, his wife, decides she doesn't like any prophet of God and goes on a killing spree herself and kills all the prophets of Yahweh. She lets the prophets of Baal and Asherah come eat at her royal table, but the prophets of the real God, she goes on a killing spree and tries to take all of them out. And so Elijah decides, you know, that's enough's enough, and he goes and confronts King Ahab, and they kind of have a showdown. And that's where we find ourselves, where we're going to start reading in 1 Kings 18. I'll start reading at verse 17 of 1 Kings 18. And it's a really cool Bible story. Verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you've abandoned the commandments of Yahweh and followed the Baals. Now therefore send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If Yahweh's God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of Yahweh, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves, and cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull, and lay it on the wood, and put no fire to it. And you will call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of Yahweh, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, "It is well spoken." So there's going to be a showdown on this mountain, Mount Carmel. Does the test make sense to you? Like, it's pretty easy direction. It's really just two steps. Step one, prophets of Baal get a bull. Prophet of God gets a bull. Step two, whichever God actually accepts the sacrifice, they're the winner. Right? Like, easy showdown, easy setup. And so then begins the test. The next verse 25. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered, and they limped around the altar that they had made. And at noon Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he's a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. So they're mutilating themselves and doing everything possible for Baal to answer them. And does he? No. I mean, like, how can he? Right? He's fake. I love Elijah's comments, though. Like, wouldn't you have loved to have been there while Elijah's openly mocking them? No, you know, Baal's probably in the bathroom, guys. That's what's going on. Maybe he ate something bad, and that's why he's not showing up. And it's, okay, which of you prophets forgot to set Baal's alarm clock this morning? Like, that would have been great to hear his bantering of them. But the day passes, nothing happens, now it's Elijah's turn. And we get to these next set of sentences. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of Yahweh that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of Yahweh came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of Yahweh, and he made a trench around the altar as great as would contain two seahs of seed. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill four jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. And so first Elijah rebuilds the altar. He does it with 12 stones. 12 stones for 12 tribes of Israel. It reminds them of what this means while he's building it. And then he digs out this trench that would fit two seahs of seeds. We don't actually know how much seahs were. Your footnote might have something, but not everybody agrees with that. But it was something smaller than like half of a bathtub. Ish. There's not really a good standard to go off of. But he's filled it enough basically to fill a bathtub around this trench. But the size of it's not important. What he actually did is what's important. Is it easy to burn wood when it's soaked in water? Is it easy to burn wood when it's sitting in a tub of water? It's actually pretty hard, right? Like, I don't know, how many of you have gone like overnight hiking when you arrive at your camp spot, you need to find wood? And then, like, if it rains the whole way, how easy is it to find good fresh wood to burn? Not good at all. Like, it's really annoying, isn't it? You really hope the person is the site before you stack up some wood or something. But wood that's wet does not burn. It just doesn't. Unless you just, like, coat it with chemicals, and the chemicals burn, not really the wood. But it does not burn very well, and so he's showing them that what's about to happen is no trick. Only the only way it's going to burn is if God shows up. And so verse 36 is what it ends out the story. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Yahweh, answer me that this people may know that you, O Yahweh, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Then the fire of Yahweh fell and consumed the burnt offering, and the wood, and the stones, and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, Yahweh, he is God, Yahweh, he is God. And Elijah said to them, Seize the prophets of Baal, let none of them escape. And they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. And the last sentence is not included in the children's version of the story, right? You haven't read that part yet, have you? I don't know. One person was, or you're just sleepy, one of the two. What happens here is God wins the showdown, right? And so the prophets of Baal, who probably were the guys who actually went and carried out the orders to kill the prophets of God, maybe not, we don't know, but we know that they mutilate themselves for their worship practices, they do all kinds of other evil things, and so basically what happened, don't feel so crazed about it, God takes out some bad guys, some justice is served, which is often a good thing. But the real story is the showdown, God wins. The real God, the God of Israel, the God who was and always will be, the God who called himself I Am or Yahweh, he won the showdown. And so, I mean, it's a cool story, right? Like, enough fire comes down to not just lick up the offering, but what else does it take out? It takes out the rocks. How many of you have tried to burn rocks? Now, we have some guys, like, is it easy to burn rocks? Anybody? Like, it's not easy to do that. So the rocks even get burnt up, and the water just vaporizes. And so the altar is taken out entirely. And so God's making a point of saying, yeah, I'm the one. I win. Like, this story is a cool story because God makes a point with it. Sometimes he just shows up and does his, you know, little subtle ways. This time it's like, nope, that I'm the right one, guys. Pay attention. And that's what happens in this story. Though, but you might ask, because this is a Christmas sermon series, I had the ugly Christmas sweatshirt on earlier. What does this have to do with Christmas? Anybody? It's Christmas time. Here's the thing. I believe God is the same God yesterday and today and forever. James tells us God never changes. God of the Old Testament is the same as the Christ of the New Testament. He saves the day. And so Jesus is in the story. In many ways, he's the one who comes and licks up the offering, but that's not makes it so much a Christmas story. Before I try to explain how I think it could be a Christmas story or a reminder of Jesus in the Christmas story, I want to be clear about one thing, though, because I'm going to kind of interpret it a little bit spiritually or allegorically in a second, but I just want to first off say, even though I'm going to say some allegorical things about it, it still really happened. Like, the story actually took place. There was a showdown between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Elijah made fun of them and won, and God showed up. Like, that actually took place. And so just one thing we can learn from this story before we try to relate it to any Christmas or New Testament stuff is be a witness for the truth and stand up, even if other witnesses to the truth are falling around you. You might sadly be one of the prophets, like the prophets who were slaughtered. You might not get your witness to be heard, but don't let your witness be shut down from your own power. Because it's worth the chance of maybe being an Elijah who gets to show off the power of God to unbelievers where God shows up and says, yeah, I'm the one in charge. It's worth that chance, the chance of maybe not getting to be that person. But it's worth the chance to do it. But beyond all that, though, Jesus is in the story. To get to that point, here's some details that we need to point out. So Elijah builds the altar, reminds people of their history with God, right? Says, you are the guys who God has worked with. God has done things to save you in your past. He's going to keep doing things to save you. He's worked with you. But then even though the sacrifice is ready to go at that point, though, then there are gallons of water poured on top, right? Four jars, three times over. A dozen times over, the sacrifice is doused with water. And remember another detail, there's a war afoot, right? There's a war between gods going on in this. Gods are battling for the hearts of men and women, for the passion of a nation. And if there's a battle between gods, got to figure out who's going to win. Will it be the God that does not react even if you do a song and dance and sacrifice yourself, bring blood, sweat, tears, pain, and everything? The God that's not real, and so you can do all these things and it really amounts to a God never answering. Will it be that God who wins the battle? I mean, you might let that fake God win the battle, but he's not going to win the war. Or maybe it'll be, though, the God who could accept the sacrifice of your life, regardless of how many times you've poured water over the top of it, regardless of how many times you've knocked over the altar or tried to let fire quench, or the fire in your spirit be quenched, regardless of how many times you've squashed the passion to follow him, regardless of how many times water's been poured over it, could that God win the battle and win the war? Yeah, he could win the war. No matter how many times you let the fire go out, the God who wins shows that he can lick up the water and still take your sacrifice. So trying to bring that to the Christmas season, it's a time where we're reminded that God takes action and loves us no matter what. That even if we've poured water over our own altars so many times, if we've doused our own bodies as sacrifices so many times, we've let the fire go out, we let it go cold, God still takes action, he still shows up, and he still wants to consume your life. So much so that he'll send his own son to get in your way and to come stand alongside of you. And he wants to be the one that wins the battle for your heart. That's the Christmas story there. And it's said in cooler, fanciful terms of this fire and altar thing. But God still wants to show up and consume your life and be your God. Not some other God that's fake. Not some God who wants you to hurt yourself, to do things that are not good choices. He wants to be your God. And if you, like Elijah, pray, O Jesus, let it be known this day that you are God, that I am your servant, answer me, turn my heart back, then God can take that sacrifice, even if it is soaked, even if it's wood that's been out in the rain. He'll accept your sacrifice. Even if your sacrifice seems ruined, there's another sacrifice 2,000 years ago. We already celebrated it earlier today, and that sacrifice had meaning or was able to happen because of the Christmas story. The Christmas story allowed that sacrifice to happen. He was born on Christmas, but he grew up a sinless man, and he died for you and me. And now even if our life seems sinful or soaked or an altar is torn down, we can be reminded of this is the things God has done for me in the past. This is what God wants to keep doing. We can be reminded of the story of Christmas, that he wants to come alongside of us, and he will accept our sacrifice. We can be accepted, even if we're soaked. In Romans chapter 12, we see from the Apostle Paul this appeal. Romans 12, 1 and 2, it says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So the question is, what fake gods, or what things of this world, because the fake gods aren't supernatural, they're just things of this world too, what things of this world try to win the war? What things try to make us be conformed to them? Is it success, or is it being content with something that's really not righteous? Is it putting something that maybe is good, like family, but putting it ahead of God so its priorities are skewed? Maybe it's money or escapism, maybe it's sports. Instead, what do? Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice to God. And even if the sacrifice, even if the altar was messed up, it can be repaired. Even if the sacrifice is doused in something and covered in water and soaked, God can still take it. God can still use it. God can still use your life, even if it's soaked, to make a point that we can talk about generations later. So we're still, thousands of years later, still talking about Elijah and what he did. God can use your life and it be talked about generations, thousands of years later, maybe. About what you were willing to do, even if the sacrifice wasn't perfect in the first place, you gave your life to him, and he's able to use it. That's something to remember during the Christmas season. Because that's what Christmas is about, is God coming near to us so that he can make a way for our lives to be used by him. And so perhaps this Christmas season, you need to remember the God who's real and approach him and say, God, you're the real God, take the sacrifice. I've not treated the altar very well. I've not treated my life very well. But God, I want you to be my God. I want you to win this. So he can win that. He can come and consume your life and make it something that's awesome for him. He can do that. Maybe you already know these things. Maybe you need the reminder, but maybe you got them down good. Maybe you are reminded of them, and so you need to go find someone else and tell them the story of Christmas, that it's God coming near to you because he can use your life no matter what. It was worth it in his eyes to send his son to die for you. That was worth it. Even if there are things messed up about this, God thinks it was worth it, and he wants to use you. And so maybe use this Christmas to remind someone of that truth, that though you may be soaked, God still wants to use you. He can work with it. Admit that you need to come home. Admit that maybe you're in a situation, you're out of place, you're not where you're supposed to be, you're stressed, and maybe you just need a hug and be sent home. God accepts you, so it's okay. You can go home to him. Please pray with me. God, we are thankful for the story of Christmas, the real true tall tale of God coming to this earth. And so, God, we are thankful that we get to experience that in our lives. May we be people who see that this means that God takes action on our behalf. You sent your son, and so, God, may we take action in response to you. May we be a living sacrifice presented to you. May we acknowledge that our lives can be used in your service. So God, may we do that now. We thank you for the example of Elijah. I say this in Jesus' name.